I mentioned this morning that besides the gradient of Bicoid, there's a maternal hunchback gradient that is there because of repression by nanos from the posterior side. And this maternal hunchback protein is there basically from the very beginning of development. So any gene that has a enhancer element that has binding sites for both Bicoid and hunchback could obviously have those filled. So this is part of the system for sure. And we actually have looked at the binding sites in the Bicoid-dependent elements that I was telling you about this morning. We looked at the binding sites for hunchback, and we find that a subset of those has a reasonable number of hunchback binding sites in those as well. And if you look at the posterior boundary of expression of those, it's always a little bit further posterior compared to ones that have Bicoid alone. So the idea is that if you have hunchback binding sites, and this is something that Ulrike Gall and co-workers found, if you have hunchback binding sites in an element that also is controlled by Bicoid, it seems that hunchback helps Bicoid activate. And we find hunchback binding sites in clusters in other elements that don't have Bicoid input, and in that case, hunchback looks like a repressor, and I'll show you some evidence of hunchback as working as a repressive gradient a little bit later today. Yeah? No, you cannot. Yes? Well, if you look at the hunchback gradient, as I'll show you, it's initially maternal, but then it's a combination of maternal and zygotic. It's not clear which ones of those are inputting into this. I don't think there's any way to tell because it's exactly the same protein. It's just the difference in the 5' untranslated region is the only difference between these transcripts. But the start site of the protein is exactly the same in those. Right? Because it's early. And because if we want to talk about it being involved in the initial activation of these, then the maternal, I mean, the zygotic certainly could be having some input into this process. But one could say that if it was only zygotic, that the zygotic hunchback is being turned on at the same time that the other Bicoid-dependent target genes are being turned on.
That's pretty interesting because you have a module right there on the site for Bicoid.
By either or both? Yes. 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 So why do I have both? Why do I not have both? Mm-hmm. I think that if you have more zygotic hunchback, if you have a higher concentration of hunchback, you're just going to increase the frequency of binding to those hunchback sites. But the hunchback sites are independent of the Bicoid ones. And what we see empirically is that if we have hunchback sites in there, that we have a further posterior boundary of expression that is made by this gradient. In all cases, these still disappear in Bicoid minus embryos. So it's always been a very difficult thing because maternal hunchback overlaps with zygotic hunchback to tease apart what both of them do. And in fact, you could take away the maternal component completely and replace it with the zygotic, and you get perfectly normal development. So there's redundancy there. But it's difficult to say that maternal hunchback is not doing something there when it's there and there's no zygotic. And so the other thing I talked about is a potential repressor gradient of Krupel from the middle part of the embryo. And if this is acting as a repressor, it could antagonize the activation ability of Bicoid and maternal hunchback. And so what we did was we looked at the 21 independent elements that respond to Bicoid. These are all Bicoid clusters, and this is a list of them on this side. And then we plotted, this is a weird plot, but this is a posterior boundary position along the AP axis. And so these are ones that have a posterior boundary between 85% and 88%. And this is a group between 70% and 80%. And there's no reason to group these like this, except it gives you a visualization of going further posterior along the embryo. But if you look at the predicted site clusters, all of them have a cluster of Bicoid binding sites. But these ones up here, that are in the anterior most part of the embryo, they have very little or any input from hunchback and crouple. And actually, if you look at clusters that have a strong hunchback component along with a strong bicoid component and no crouple component, these are the ones that are expressed furthest posterior. So this kind of combination, I mean, this is a very small sample set. So, but there still looks like there's a trend here to me that if you add hunchback sites here without crouple sites, that you extend further posterior. Now, something we don't understand at all is this set here in green, where we have bicoid input, very little hunchback input, and a lot of crouple input, and these seem to be consistently expressed further posterior than the ones with bicoid only. And this is a surprise to us. We don't know what this means at all, but it's possible that this set of elements has another factor that helps bicoid to activate. Or another possibility is that the crouple binding site actually in some cases can overlap the bicoid binding site. And one model is that by having crouple in there some of the time, the chromatin is in a more open configuration so that it's more available for bicoid to bind. But we haven't figured this out at all. Yeah? Uh-huh. Crouple is expressed from 55, the RNA is from 55 to 45% embryo length. Okay? And so then you should have a gradient that diffuses toward the upper numbers from 55%. No. Sorry, say that again. Yes. So this is 55% egg length here. Oh, and there are some that get expressed through where the crouple domain is, yes. But these don't have crouple inputs. So this one right here is very close. That's the EVE2 enhancer. That's right at the 55% line. That's right at the edge of where crouple is. But these ones that are expressed in the region where you have crouple, they don't have crouple binding sites. These. They're to the left of crouple. 100 is the anterior tip. Yeah, and that's just a convention. Sorry, the head is over here. Oh, this is much more confusing than I thought. Yeah, Nicola.
I'm a little surprised that you have so little hunchback. And dinner, but the hunchback where the bicoid
moves. Yeah?
So, I mean, that's really burning it between a whole.
Homotypic clustering? Well, what? Saying that there's no hunchback input is almost impossible. But we know of, actually, if you look at the whole set, and we've looked at the whole set for hunchback binding sites, many of them have only one hunchback site or two hunchback sites. And there's a dearth of these poly A stretches, which is basically a hunchback site. And you don't see those in these. No. This is just counting sites that are within the bicoid cluster. No. We didn't do that. We didn't do that, and this is extremely preliminary and very arbitrary. Okay? And I think that we're in the process of testing these ones that have question marks. Actually, we're in the process of testing them all. So if you take this element and put it into a crouple mutant, you would expect to see an expansion in the crouple mutant if crouple is having an effect. But these experiments aren't finished yet. But this is just an idea that we have to try to help explain the position is by integrating three inputs instead of just the single bicoid input. Yeah. This one. Yeah, this is the zygotic hunchback expression domain, and that was the one that I showed you at first. It has a nice bicoid cluster right next to the basal transcription machinery. And that one, yes, that's the famous one that Vishaus has been working on, is the hunchback P2, and their estimation for the posterior boundary is 48 to 50%. Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. And that's always been a danger with using that thing is just a simple Bitcoin readout, is that there are more things than Bitcoin input to that element. Well, I'm quite sure that if you take the Bitcoin sites and the Hunchback Promoter by themselves, you never get expression back to 50%. And I can show you experiments where people tried to do that. In fact, if you only put Bitcoin sites into a reporter element, you can only get expression, I would say, 75% in further anterior. It's a positive input. Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. There are cases where if you remove Bitcoin, you see an expansion of an expression pattern, which would make you think that it's acting as a repressor. But in all those cases, it looks like Bitcoin's activating something else that acts as a repressor. I see no evidence that Bitcoin protein by itself has a repression domain. No evidence of that at all. And the way it acts, I think, is always as an activator. And I'm not a huge fan of the idea that proteins are multifunctional very often. I think that proteins can be in complexes that are activation complexes or repression complexes, but the protein itself, normally I would say it could have an activation domain or a repression domain, and it's a rare protein that has both of those. And I think that that when people have looked carefully at a lot of these, but I think Bitcoin is unique in that way in the early embryo, and it's one of the few things that activate, because most of the patterning is done by repression, as far as I can see. Almost all the patterning, especially the precise patterning, is done by repression. I don't know. I mean, if I just think about repression, I think activation is a complicated process. You have to have activators bound. They have to make contact with basal machinery with that complex. There's acetylation mechanisms involved. There's the release of the polymerase. There are many things involved in activation. And I would say activation is much more complicated than repression, because repression can actually work. Repression is flexible. It can work by screwing up any part of that process, and you can get it not to work. And I think that's actually something that we see, because I'm going to show you a repression gradient later today. And that repression gradient is very precise in putting things in one cell or in one cell next to it. But if we look at the elements, and I'm not going to show you the elements because I don't know really how to analyze them, we can't see anything that is a simple way that this is being read out by the element. So the only way I can think about this is that it has to do with what proteins are activating it and the fact that the repression mechanism could be more flexible than the activation one. Absolutely, yes. Well, I mean, Eric talked about this idea of a dynamic lockdown for repression. And he said basically that the repressor has to bind there, it has to stay there. But we know many cases where a repressor binds, it turns off the gene, but then the repressor is gone and the gene stays off. And there's very good evidence that, like, the polycomb group genes are involved in maintaining this repressive state, and that it's more complicated than that, for sure. Yes. Yes. I mean, yes. Some of us who work on sequence-specific binding factors, we don't like to talk about chromatin, but I don't see why, because it's part of the process as well. I don't think it's the strong regulator, chromatin modification. I think that a lot of the stuff that we see is a function of transcription or a result of transcription. But having said that, you can have modifications that then go from one cell through a cell division, and so those modifications are there still, and that is some memory for the cell to remember which genes are turned on and off, and then it could be sort of in front. I think saying which one is in front is, I don't know, dangerous. I think it's the opposite. Yeah, I think that's true. Okay. So I think we can just conclude this part and then get started on something different, and that is that I think that BiCoid activates very few target genes by itself. That for most target genes, BiCoid functions combinatorially, maybe with these two proteins, and it would be really nice if it's not more complicated than these three inputs to make this one boundary. It creates a broad anterior domain that can be refined by repression, both at the posterior side to make a posterior boundary, and as we were talking about before, at the anterior side, so that you make a stripe of expression, and Krupel may act as a repressor on some of these. And the position of the posterior boundary might be a complex function involving three genes, where these two basically have plus roles, or activation roles, and this one has a negative role on how sensitive an element is to activation by BiCoid. Okay? Now, so we have this idea that combinations are important. And one extreme view is that combinations are the whole story. And the other extreme view, which I think is too simple as well, is that the BiCoid concentration is the whole story. And so we can ask, do target genes actually care about BiCoid concentration? And one way to do this is we could try to make embryos with different levels of flat BiCoid. So we could try to use genetics to take the gradient and make it as flat as possible. And then by putting multiple copies of the BiCoid gene, we can put different levels of a relatively flat BiCoid gradient into the embryo and test to see whether target genes are turned on or off by threshold-dependent mechanisms. Yeah. I'll show you. Okay. So the BiCoid mRNA is anchored by a complex that forms in the nurse cells, and a big part of that complex is this gene product called exuperantia, which is required for anchoring BiCoid mRNA to the anterior tip. And remember, I told you this morning that BiCoid RNA has this nanoresponsive element in it, and so we have to remove the posterior patterning system from these embryos as well, or you still get the gradient by default by repression of translation. And we do that by this mutation here, which is called VASA, and that makes sure that you have no translation or repression from the posterior. And this is what these embryos look like. So this is a wild-type BiCoid localization at the anterior tip. This is an embryo that has two copies of the BiCoid gene in this VASA exu double mutant. And this is actually one of the better ones. A lot of them have a sort of much, much broader gradient of RNA than you can see, but we do see some embryos where it looks relatively flat along the anterior-posterior axis. And as I was saying before, we can vary the copy number. So this one has the two normal copies of BiCoid in this mutant. But then Nussbaum-Volhardt and Wolfgang Drever made these rescue constructs for BiCoid, and you can put extra copies of BiCoid into these embryos as well. And this was the same way that people altered the BiCoid gradient to push all of the segmentation expression patterns into the posterior end that I was telling you about. So this is 4X and stained for BiCoid. And if we look here, this is exactly the same thing that I showed you last time, or in the last slide, and this is the wild-type expression pattern, and in a wild-type embryo, OTD is a target gene of BiCoid. It's expressed in the anterior about a quarter of the embryo, and if you flatten BiCoid like this, and this is 2X BiCoid again, this thing has a very hard time turning on at all. might be a tiny bit of expression right here, and once in a while we see a duplication of that expression pattern back here, but it's a lot less expression than you see in the wild type. But the nice thing is that if you increase the concentration by 2 by putting in 4 copies of Bicoid, you can now turn this on very strongly throughout the embryo. And so we're really interested in using this as, the nice thing is that these are maternal effect mutations. So VASA and EXU are other maternal effect genes. So we can get moms that are VASA EXU minus, and they will lay 100% of their embryos are VASA EXU minus. And so this is a nice set of embryos to use in microarray experiments. And that's what we're doing with them. Sorry. That's very consistent with this idea of a threshold. And we know we're in the right concentration ballpark because these are the endogenous expression levels of the Bicoid gene. That's what's kind of nice about this. We're not blasting it with a heat shock of Bicoid or something like that. I think that that's true. I think that these things are on the low side of the total Bicoid concentration, but they're still in the ballpark, I would say. And I think that it might be something less than a doubling going from here to here. I agree with that. Because actually, we don't know the expression level of the transgene. Yes, we talked about that this morning. That basically is just changing the shape of the gradient, but it's still a really nice gradient. And you shift where the sulfates are toward the posterior side, but it will develop fine. No, I think if you look, this is a sagittal view, actually, that Marty was talking about. These two are sagittal views, and you can see individual nuclei here. And what the sagittal view means is that it's a section like this, right through the middle of the embryo. We're not looking at the surface anymore. So that's why it looks a little bit more diffuse. But if you did come back to the surface, there is expression all the way back to here in the individual nuclei. No, these are just DIC images with... chemical stain. They're not. It's more. I don't know how much more. And actually, she's done that, though. She's done RT-PCRs on these, QRT-PCRs on these. And I would say that in a group of embryos that she gets from this genotype, if you can get some expression of OTD in some of those embryos. So it's not zero. But the fold difference between here is at least tenfold, I would say. I wouldn't go a lot further than that. Yeah. Yes. And we'll talk about trying to quantify things a little bit later, because there are ways to do it. We can put fluorescence probes on these RNA probes that we use, and we can then do a lot better job with confocal microscopy just doing fluorescence intensity and that sort of thing. And that's actually what we've started to do. But OTD in this scheme suggests that it's a high-level target. You have to have a relatively high level of Bicoid to get activation. And hunchback, on the other hand, so this is the hunchback RNA pattern, and you can see how dynamic this pattern is. So the ones I showed you before, there's a cap of hunchback on the anterior part of the anterior part of the embryo. And this is just a tiny bit later. The anterior part of this cap dies, and there's another expression pattern of hunchback, which is 2 stripes. This one is a parasegment 4 stripe, and that comes up, and that actually complicates the determination of where this boundary of gene expression is. So to go back to the old Rieschhaus paper that I think a lot of you guys know, they measured hunchback protein levels at a time that's very similar to this. And so there's input not only from Bicoid, but also from this other element that makes this parasegment 4 stripe and actually is part of the mechanism that sharpens that boundary. So they came up with this idea that when they measure Bicoid at this time, it's a really variable concentration gradient. And when they look at hunchback, the hunchback domain is made up of multiple inputs that really don't have anything to do with Bicoid input. So I think that they have a different idea about what's happening now than they came up with in that paper. It's a different, that's right. Well, I know Eric had a lot of trouble with that. I don't blame him. But this is just to tell you that I don't have a lot of data to show you, but we should. We finally got the tiling arrays from AFI, and we want to do 1x, 2x, 4x, 6x Bicoid, and then Bicoid minus embryos, and do microarrays on those to try to find. And we expect to see the target genes that I showed you perform in the way that they do on those, and that will be our set. And we have a lot of target genes for that. But the idea is to find new target genes, and specifically with the focus on discovering more regulatory elements that can't be found by our current model, which is pretty strict. And so if you find genes that are turned on by Bicoid, then you can relax the search method for a cluster of Bicoid binding sites. You can probably find that actually quite easily in a short region that's around those genes, and then take those, see if they work, and then put those back into the model, and this will be a reiterative process that I can see before we figure this out. I didn't tell you what we're doing right now with respect to the latest things that we're testing, but I have a couple students, and I just had them look at the data for Bicoid hunchback and Krupel inputs. And I have one doing Bicoid only, one doing Bicoid plus hunchback, one doing Bicoid plus hunchback plus Krupel, one plus Bicoid plus Krupel, no hunchback. And they're doing like 6 of each. And they're pretty excited because they really think that they'll have different classes of expression patterns. And they might not. And they might not all work. But I think that we're really trying to test the kind of computational model that we can find these elements in the genome. That's what's happening. Okay? Any questions about that? Yeah?
Just curious about the microarray device. You have some preliminary data showing what kind of action you can still detect to replace it. You have something like.
We've done a lot of QRT-PCRs on the RNA samples that she's going to use because these things are really expensive for us. And those like that OTD pattern that I showed you where it looks almost white, there is definitely some expression level that you can see there. And so everything has to be normalized to like a tubulin control or something like that. And but we feel like we can see tenfold differences at least with the target genes that we see. And we'll just wait and see what happens. I don't know if that really answers your question. Well, I think that's the beauty of this is that by having this as a genotype, oh, I think it's no problem. Because this is on a per nucleus basis. And we're just increasing the number of nuclei that are giving us one particular set of cell types. I think we're just spreading out the gradient into a series of different purified populations of embryos. That's the idea. It's not going to be perfect. And these things are not completely flat all the time. So I think it'll be a little bit sloppy when we look at it, but hopefully we'll be able to use this kind of information. Krupel is interesting because that one actually goes away completely in these. But the reason for that is because these genes, Giant and Hunchback, are known to be strong repressors of Krupal. So by putting them all over the embryo, you're turning Krupal completely off. We can make sense of everything on this page with what we already know, and we're hoping to use this kind of information to guide us in determining like the mechanisms that are involved in the new target genes that we find. So I want to tell you about making patterns of stripes, because so far I've told you how you can make pretty simple expression patterns, and that is you have a gradient of expression. That gradient is read out so that you can make a posterior boundary of expression, and then if other things are involved in repression, you can make a stripe. But we know from things that I showed you this morning that things are expressed in stripes. And the favorite gene that we've worked on for some time is this gene even-skipped, and this is the RNA expression pattern for even-skipped. You can see that it's a relatively regular series of stripes along the anterior-posterior axis. We know that if you look at this striped pattern in embryos that are mutant for the gap genes, that this pattern gets disrupted in a pretty profound way. For example, if you look in a giant mutant, you get a fusion of these two stripes. Three of these stripes come together. A Krupal mutant, you end up with a four-stripe pattern where you have stripes on the outside that look real, but then two sort of broad blotches of staining in the middle part of the embryo, suggesting that Krupal is critical for making these five stripes of Eve. And this doesn't help us too much understand the mechanism, because if you look at the whole pattern, basically you're seeing the inputs from a bunch of different regulatory elements. And this is the results of several years of reporter gene analysis. And basically what we do here is we take pieces of the promoter, put them in front of a reporter gene, make transgenic flies that contain those, get embryos from them, stain those for LACSI expression or reporter gene expression. And what we see when we dissect this promoter is that there's an element here around 500 bases that gives a single stripe at the position of stripe 2. There's another one over here that gives also about 500 bases that gives expression of stripes 3 and a bit of stripe 7, but not a strong stripe 7. There's one here that makes stripes 4 and 6, one here that makes stripe 1, and one here that makes stripe 5. But if you put together these five different regulatory elements, what you come up with are seven stripes that are relatively evenly spaced along the anterior-posterior axis. It's very counterintuitive, but I think it's the way it works, and I'll show you some of the data. So even skip stripe 2 is something that we've worked on for quite a long time. I started working on this in Mike Levine's lab in the early 90s. And this is a CRM, or cis regulatory module, for Eve. This is 500 bases. And you can see that there are binding sites here for activators. And this is a Bicoid-dependent element. So there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 binding sites for Bicoid, and then one hunchback site, which is involved in activation, and then there are binding sites for repressors. And basically what this does is Bicoid and hunchback activate throughout the anterior half of the embryo, and you can see that by removing all of these repressors. But you refine to a stripe because of repressive interactions by Krupal on the posterior side, and then this series of repressors on the anterior side. We don't know. We've had an idea about that for some time. But we've never been able to show. And actually, we did some experiments a long time ago where we took the stripe 2 enhancer, and then we got nucleosome positioning sequences from Alan Wolf, and we stuck those next to it, hoping to interfere with it in some way. But these never worked for us. This one, 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 this one. 13. For the repressors, you have to mutate them all to see an effect, or to see a strong effect, just like Eric was talking about. But for the activators, it's astonishing. If you mutate this one, the stripe is just not made. If you mutate that one, the stripe is just not made. If you mutate this one, it's weaker. And if you mutate these two, they're weaker. And it turns out that these three are weaker affinity binding sites compared to these two. These two are the strongest affinity sites. And they seem to be most critical. that these overlap like this. It's very interesting that they overlap. And we've had an idea that there's competition between the repressors and the activators that's for binding that is involved in this process of repression. But I've never been able to do a clean enough experiment with gel shift to show whether or not the repressor and the activator can bind the sequence at the same time. We've had, I mean, these are not easy proteins to work with. These zinc finger proteins, the cuprol is a pain to work with, giant is not easy, bicoid, hunchback's another zinc finger. And maybe we're not great biochemists, and we should send this stuff to Eric, but we haven't successfully shown that those two proteins can bind to the same piece of DNA. This is part of what I wanted to talk about at the very end. The spacing that you see between these does appear to be important. We did a bunch of experiments where we deleted the spacing between known binding sites, and every single deletion that we make has an effect. So we don't completely understand, but there are two ways to interpret those experiments. If you delete this, you might be deleting something that's important either for activation or repression, but you're also bringing this repressor site closer to this activator site, and the changing in the spacing of those might be the thing that's causing it. We would love to know what inert sequence is, because then we could replace this sequence with something that doesn't have any activity, but we don't really know how to do that. We've tried a lot of things. We've tried coding regions from bacterial proteins. We've tried many things, and I can't say for sure that we have a piece of DNA that has no activity. Yeah, Dominic. Yes, all of one kind. It's very hard because up until now we haven't been able to do anything quantitative. Remember, I was telling you that on Monday. And so if you look at these, you can squint your eyes a little bit and say, I think this one is 6 cells wide instead of 5 cells wide. But this thing is refining with time also. So there's a time factor that you have to worry about. And since they're in different positions in the genome, the things that you're trying to compare with each other, it just made it too difficult. And we have a lot of data that's not published where we think something is happening, but we want to do it in a better way. Okay. This is really some data that comes from Mike Levine's lab where they tried to look at this repression mechanism, and they have an idea. Actually, I had this idea when I was in Mike's lab. We did it first. But the idea is that this is a short-range repression mechanism. And if you have activator sites in one region, one way that you can ensure that other elements can work in a complex promoter is by having the repression only occur at the level of the enhancer. Does that make sense? So that's consistent with the idea that these repressor sites are tightly linked to the activator sites that are in this element. And what that says is that when this is in a repressed state, cuprol is bound here, but the main thing it does is it prevents the binding of bicoid to this element or the ability of bicoid to activate transcription through this element. But it doesn't have to contact the basal transcription machinery for this repression to occur. And that leaves it possible. So where this cuprol domain is, certainly these binding sites will have a high frequency of occupancy, right? And in this region right here is where you actually have to activate this 3+7 element. Okay, because that's where the stripe 3 is made, is right in the middle of the cuprol domain. And if this thing is turned off, and if this repression of this element involves somehow locking down this basal transcription machinery, then how is the 3+7 element going to get over there? So our model has always been that it's a short-range repression mechanism where these binding sites have to be relatively close to the activators. And Mike Levine's lab, Dave Arnosti, Susan Gray, and other people have tested this By mutating these binding sites, not the ones in the STRIPE2 enhancer, but in other enhancers, but if you mutate a repressor site inside the element, you can move it out here and it still works. And if you're within 50 bases of an activator site, it still works. But if you move it to 150 bases, then it no longer works. And they call this a short-range repression mechanism, and they have other repression mechanisms that they call long-range repressors, where the repressor can be really, really far away from the activators, and they think that's a more direct contact with the basal transcription machinery mechanism. Uli? Touch each other. I think from the size of the proteins they could, but there's no evidence that they do. And none of the two hybrids that have done with these proteins have pulled out the other proteins. That would be the best. And it looks like the repressors work with co-repressors, like Krupal works with CTBP. And Giant might do that as well. Hunchback, nobody knows what the co-repressor is for that one. But these are co-repressors which are recruited to the binding site, but then how they function is not clear at all, especially for short-range repression. For long-range repression, people think that they accumulate deacetylases and they change the chromatin and that spreads out from where they are, and that's a long-range repression mechanism. Okay. People have done lots of yeast 2 hybrids with DCTBP, with Groucho, with other co-repressors, this atrophin. And as far as I know, nobody has ever picked up an activation domain with that. I know about the first two. I know about Groucho and DCTBP. It would be nice if we could somehow put together a mechanistic model with this idea that they have to be close. But so far we don't have that. Oh, sorry. Marty's lab has done that. Marty Kreitman's lab has done exactly that. They have a transgene that has this whole thing, so about a 16 kb transgene, which is no mean feat to put that in there. And if they delete the minimal STRIPE2 enhancer from this element, they get a low level expression of STRIPE2. That's, everybody else is fine. No, I don't think so. Yeah. This is a late element, and this is an element that is required for sharpening the stripes once that they're made. And it was thought for a while that this actually had binding sites for even skip itself, so that once the EVE protein was made, it would bind to this and then it would auto-regulate and increase the expression levels. But it actually turns out that there's another protein paired, which is the major activator of this. But it's another pair rule protein that's in 7 stripes. And there's a lot of refinement of these stripes that happens between the pair rule genes that I told you are in these reciprocal expression domains. Yeah. Repress each other. There is some mutual repression between these, but it's not always the pairs that you might think. But that's a really big part of it. So each even skip stripe sort of comes up as this thing that looks like a bell-shaped thing that's about 6 cells wide. And then over the course of like the next half hour, that gets turned into a really much sharper stripe that has a very sharp anterior boundary, and then it fades out on the posterior boundary. And that's the function of the other pair rule genes working on this thing. So what we see here is this idea that 5 elements are making a pattern like this, but in fact, you wouldn't be able to see the pattern that these 5 elements made. And this is something I think would be really fun to do, unless you took the individual elements and put them all into the same embryo. It would be really cool to see how even that pattern was. Because this is really important, I think. as soon as the early elements turn on the expression of individual stripes, the other parallel genes are being turned on, and this regulation between the parallels starts immediately. It doesn't wait until they're all made. So it's actually quite complicated set of interactions that involve all the gap genes and all the parallel genes working on each other to make these things really look refined. Now, if you look later than this, this stripe pattern can look much better. It can look much sharper and really look like bands around the embryo. But this is a quite early one. Okay, so the reason I have this again is that what I want to talk about now is two different enhancers, the 3 plus 7 enhancer, which we see here, and the 4 plus 6 enhancer. And we cannot, if you make these smaller, separate the stripe 3 response from the stripe 7 response or the stripe 4 response from the stripe 6 response. And that suggests that these pairs of stripes are made by common mechanisms. And I'll show you what those mechanisms are in a second. The mechanisms involve KNURPS, which acts as a repressor that's on the inside of these two pairs of stripes. So this is 3 and 7, which are made by one stripe element, and this is 4 and 6, which are made by a different stripe element. And you can see the KNURPS RNA is in this region here. It's not perfectly in between those, but it is between those two stripes. And then Hunchback, which we've been talking about, is in red here. Hunchback is in an anterior domain that abuts the anterior boundary of stripe 3, and in a posterior domain, which overlaps with, but is posterior as well to the stripe 7 position. And the model, and actually we can test these. So this is a genetic analysis of the 3-7 and 4-6 enhancers. So this is what the 3-7 element looks like driving a reporter gene in a wild-type embryo. You can see stripe 3 there. And stripe 7 is actually quite weak compared to the endogenous stripe. But that's because all of the information to make stripe 7 is not included in this element. But if you look in an embryo that has no KNURPS, and remember KNURPS was the one that was in the middle, you see a complete derepression of this pattern, suggesting that KNURPS is one of the critical repressors in between these two stripes, and that it makes a boundary of expression here and a boundary of expression here on this enhancer. And you see the same thing in a KNURPS mutant for the 4-6 enhancer. You see a complete derepression in this region. In a Hunchback mutant, you see the opposite, which is the anterior boundary of this one expands toward the anterior part of the embryo, and the stripe 7 response gets a lot stronger and expands toward the posterior side. And this is consistent with the idea that Hunchback is a repressive activity that forms the anterior boundary in this case and this case, and also the posterior boundary of that. And you see the same kind of outward expansion for 4-6 in this mutation. So what that suggests is that KNURPS is a domain that's in between these two pairs of stripes. It's expressed, the RNA is expressed in this region, and then the protein that is made by the KNURPS RNA is free to diffuse, and a very low level of KNURPS makes this boundary and this boundary, whereas a much higher level of KNURPS is required to make a boundary here. So it's kind of a quantitative difference in the sensitivity between the 3-7 enhancer. Now this is a single enhancer element that makes both of these stripes and this enhancer that makes these two stripes. Well, I'll talk to you about that in a second. We thought we did. We did an experiment that's very good, but we were lucky. And I'll tell you why. But you can see for Hunchback, it's the opposite sensitivities, right? So if Hunchback is a domain that makes a gradient that comes in this direction, stripe 4 will be very sensitive to Hunchback because it's further away from where the gradient is, and stripe 3 will be less sensitive, and you have the same thing happening on the other side. So Hunchback is a gradient that makes the outside boundaries. KNURPS is a gradient that makes the inside boundaries of the stripe. And we could test this by doing this ventral misexpression scheme that I told you about on Monday. And in this case, we use a snail promoter. Remember, a snail promoter is a ventrally expressed gene. It's expressed along the ventral surface of the embryo. And you can see that expression pattern here. And I've shown you the Hunchback expression pattern a few times now. And this is Hunchback protein now. And this is the anterior domain of Hunchback and the posterior domain. But this is the ventral gradient. And actually, this is nice because we have expression on the ventral side. But you can see progressively less Hunchback protein as you look toward the dorsal side. And this dorsal ventral gradient is interesting because we should be able to see repression thresholds if different stripes are differentially sensitive to a gradient of that. And you can see this here. So this is a wild type embryo showing really beautiful Eve stripes that are later than the ones I showed you before. So these are refined. You can see they have really sharp boundaries on the anterior side and less sharp on the posterior side of each stripe. And if you look at an embryo that has KNURPS in this ventral domain, and the ventral domain, so now we're looking right at the belly of the embryo. In this domain with 1X, so this is a single copy of this transgene, you have a very nice repression of stripe 3. And if you remember where KNURPS was, KNURPS is normally expressed in this region between 4 and 6. And if it is involved in making this boundary, for the posterior boundary of 3 and the anterior boundary of 7, then this element should be really, really sensitive to ectopic expression. And that's exactly what we see. So a single copy gives a really strong repression of EVE3 and EVE7, and much less repression of 4 and 6. But actually, if you increase the copy number here, we have now a nice repression of 4 and 6, but a lot less repression than you see with 3 and 7. Does that make sense? Okay. So for KNURPS, it actually looks pretty good that, first of all, KNURPS is sufficient to do the repression, and second, that these two different sets of stripes that are made by two different enhancers seem to be differentially sensitive to the repression. And for hunchback, that's what it looks like. Go ahead. So this is the same view of a wild-type embryo, and this is with hunchback. And remember, hunchback is the one that comes from the outside, and so the inside stripe should be the most sensitive. And that's what we see with 1X of snail hunchback. Stripe 4 and stripe 6 are really well repressed, as well as stripe 5, but there's little effect on stripe 3 and 7 here. And if we increase the copy number, then we can get a repression of stripe 3. Not much of stripe 7, but if we increase the copy number even more, we can get some repression of stripe 7. And so this is consistent with the idea that this thing is acting as a morphogen also, because this repression is a lot less than what you see here, suggesting that the element that makes stripe 3 is a lot less sensitive than the one that makes stripe 4. Because they shift like this. Okay, there's a reason for that also. And that is that the model is that you have one stripe here, and it's KNURPS on this side that's making the boundary, and hunchback on this side making the other boundary, right? And so the thing that I haven't told you is that if you ectopically express hunchback, you kill KNURPS as well. So KNURPS is dying, and then hunchback just swamps it out. But when it dies, so this is hunchback. So KNURPS is removed from this part of the embryo, but not from this part of the embryo here, because that's on the side, right? And so that you have this interface between the one that's on the side and having no KNURPS here, and that shifts the boundaries. That makes these stripes turn a little bit. Yes?
What about the one that you're trying to correlate?
Yeah, that's what I'll show you right here. And this just shows you that if you look at the individual reporter genes, that you see the same thing. So it is actually the sequence that's in those reporter genes. This is a stripe 3 LAC-Z response showing a very strong repression by KNURPS. And this is stripe 4, which shows a lot less. And you see the opposite sensitivity for hunchback. This is the boundary of the endogenous snail expression domain. That's the gene that we use to make the expression domain along the ventral surface. And that makes a very beautiful boundary between the part that will be the mesoderm later and the mesectoderm, which is right next to it. And Mike Levine's lab has done a lot of study about how this boundary is made and different boundaries along the DV axis. And he'll actually be here in a little bit more than a week to talk about that. Now, to answer Rolf's question, if you look at the EVE promoter region, and this is something we've seen before, There's the 2 enhancer here, the 3-7 enhancer here, and the 4-6 enhancer. If you search this region for clusters of hunchback sites, you can see a really strong cluster here, which correlates with where the 4-6 element is, and this one is the one that's very sensitive to hunchback. There's a weaker cluster, but a significant cluster of hunchback sites here where the 3-7 is, and you see the opposite kind of heat sensitivity for those two. Now this is really cool because it gives us a mechanism. It's a strength of binding that is correlated with the sensitivity of these elements. And we like this. We like it because it explains the phenomenology, but it would be really nice if this kind of a mechanism was involved in setting the boundaries of many different genes along the AP axis. And so we've actually, I don't know why this is so beautiful, but we did do an experiment in the paper that this was in, where we converted this element into one that was in between the apparent sensitivity of the 4-6 element and the 3-7 element, and we were able to shift the boundary in an amazingly perfect number of cells. But we know now that that was a completely lucky experiment, because we think that our ability to detect a KNURPS binding site is not very good. And we've done a lot more work to try to remove all the KNURPS binding function from those elements. And we basically end up with no expression when we mutate what we think are all the KNURPS binding sites. So either we're interfering with activator sites in the same element, or we have not a very good idea of what a KNURPS binding site is. And so Paolo Struffi in my lab is going through the pain of taking all the things that were predicted to be KNURPS binding sites and doing gel shifts with those and with our so-called mutated versions of those. And we have position weight matrices values that are quite similar, but we can see 200- or 300-fold differences in the ability to bind KNURPS. And so we're worried about this matrix, and he's doing select experiments to try to get a much better idea of what this position weight matrix is. Yes, absolutely. Nicely. Well, a gel shift is nothing like physiological. A gel shift is the set of conditions that you can get for your very high concentration of protein with a pretty high concentration or pretty low concentration of a probe. And I don't know if you guys have done these experiments, but if you want something to bind in a gel shift and you work really hard, you can pretty much make it happen. And it's true. But if you see a nice gel shift and then you mutate it and you see an effect in the embryo, then we believe a gel shift. So there is a way to prove that what you see is real. But biochemistry is something that is, you don't want to take it just by itself. You can, and these are experiments that we're trying to do right now. But I can tell you, with the old matrix that we got from the known KNURPS binding sites, it's not good at all at predicting what is a good binding site and what is not. It's not completely wrong, but we have the wrong critical basis, I would say. I don't know. He just got a bunch of selects data back this week, and we only have like 50 sequences that shift, you know, out of the matrix, and we don't see anything in there yet. So I don't know what that means. I don't know if the experiment is not working well or if it's a pretty nonspecific binder. I don't know what it means. Yeah, it's a zinc finger protein. It's extremely insoluble and extremely hard to work with. And I mean, you guys don't really do experiments, so I should tell you some secrets. There are lots of DNA binding studies out there where people, they express the protein in bacteria, and the bacteria is put into the protein is put into these inclusion bodies, and it's extremely insoluble, and the bacteria just like puts it into these particles so that it can't bother the bacterium. And so the experimenter is faced with this stuff that's completely insoluble, and there are a couple things to do. So you can denature it, like you can add urea, or you can add some other denaturant. And then you can either dialyze out the denaturant and try to renature the protein so that now you still have some that's a little bit soluble and hopefully has a tiny bit of activity left after this brutal thing that you do to it. Or some people, and I know of papers like this, they leave the protein in like 1 molar urea and do the gel shift in with 1 molar urea protein. And if they get a little shift, they say this is binding, and then if you mutate it and you don't get the shift, they say it's specific. But if you go back and you mutate the site in vivo, then you still believe it. But I mean, in a perfect world, everything would be nice, and all the experiments that people tell you about are things that you could just completely believe. But I don't think it's always true. And so I think the more you guys know about how these things work, the better it is, because you know, then you don't just take this matrix of this set of binding sites and say, these are for sure. There's always some doubt about these things. And as we go and accumulate more data about how each one of these proteins bind, then hopefully we'll get closer to the truth instead of further away. Okay. Now. Okay, I'm going to do something. I like this a lot, so I'm going to tell you about it. So I want to tell you about the morphogenetic gradient of hunchback. And hunchback, we think, is involved in helping Bicoid activate some target genes. But when there is no Bicoid in the target gene, we think it acts as a repressor. And I just showed you two elements, the E3 enhancer and the E4 enhancer, that respond to hunchback in a repressive way. And so we're interested in this hunchback gradient, and this is the way the first hunchback gradient is formed, and that's by repression by nanos of maternal hunchback so that the hunchback protein gradient looks like this, and I'll show you a picture of that in a second. And then there's redundancy between the maternal hunchback and Bicoid-dependent zygotic hunchback, so that when Bicoid activates zygotic hunchback, you have an overlap between the maternal stuff that's there and the zygotic stuff. And nanos is still repressing this, because nanos is still there. And so these are target genes of hunchback, and these are actually quite difficult experiments to do. These are done by Dan Yang Yu, a graduate student in my lab. And if we could turn the lights out, but we don't really need to, you could see, can you see red dots here? Okay. What about here? Do you see green dots? No. There's black dots in there. There's a few green dots, but they're mostly black. Right? Now, look at that. See those dots? Those are black. The reason they're black is that the cuprol is RNA, and so the nuclei appear to be black. But in this case, the hunchback is protein, and so we're visualizing the hunchback protein gradient with an RNA pattern that it is supposed to be regulating. We think this is really important because if this is a transcriptional regulator, you want to look at transcription of the target genes and not the diffused protein pattern of those target genes. Okay. And we can plot this. So what Dan Yang does is she puts a box in here that covers from 80% egg length to about 20% egg length, and I'll show you one of those in a second. And we can plot the relative concentrations. Well, it's actually relative fluorescence intensity according to the position along the AP axis. And you can see that this hunchback protein expression domain overlaps substantially with the cuprol expression domain. No, these are different target genes. So this is cuprol. This is KNURPS, which is further posterior. This is GIANT, which is further posterior. These are two other gap-like genes, NUBBIN and PDM2, which are expressed in a domain that is in between these guys. And then we already talked about the fact that hunchback is a regulator of E-stripe-3 and E-stripe-4. But I like this because what we're trying to do here is image the RNA patterns that are directly being regulated by the protein gradient here. And what we can do is we can... The red is protein in all cases. Yeah. In all these cases, it's red protein. And the green is RNA for the different target genes. Okay? So this is a protein gradient that might be involved in repression of this one to form this anterior boundary. And we could plot where you have or the amount of hunchback, relative hunchback protein that you have at a position where you're getting 50% repression of the target gene. Okay. If we do that here, it's at roughly 50% maximum hunchback concentration. If you look at KNURPS, here's the way the hunchback protein looks, and it crosses this in a much, much lower amount of protein, and we estimate that this is in the 8 to 10% range, but I would never, ever put an error bar on that at this moment. But this is really preliminary, but I think it's quite exciting. This is the hunchback protein gradient again, and we know that this boundary, this domain of giant, is actually being controlled in some way by that hunchback gradient. And this is a very, very low percentage of the maximum hunchback concentration. Nubbin and PDM2 are about at the same level. And if you look at EVE and SKIPT 3 and EVE 4, EVE is about at 30% of the maximum hunchback concentration, and 4 is in the 8 to 10% range. Sorry? Different, that's exactly right. Different genes, no, nothing at all. I think that if you took away the crupule here, you would see a lot of hunchback in this region right here, but the red actually appears sort of dark. And I don't think there's a big difference between this boundary here and this one here. Yeah. I mean, we could easily do that just by taking the green away from that embryo. Okay. That's right. But we know that the red curve moves. And that's what I want to talk about. Because if a gene is really being controlled by a certain concentration of protein, then that gene's expression boundary should move when the gradient moves. Okay? And so this is actually what we see when we look at the hunchback protein gradient. And so this is an early embryo. You don't see any expression in this posterior time. And I would bet that this embryo is being regulated by this embryo has hunchback in here that's a combination of the maternal stuff and the stuff that's turned on by Bicoid, but not the later stuff. So to get back to the Vishal's old paper, they should never have seen any, they should never have measured any hunchback protein gradients when there's any expression back here. And I think if you remember those papers, almost all of their plots had expression back here, and that has other inputs into the hunchback. So this domain actually starts to refine, and see, this is the parasegment 4 expression coming up here, and you can see that here quite nicely. And so this thing actually is a broader gradient early, and then it starts to sharpen like this until it comes down here. And if genes are really determining their position by sensitivity to this, they shouldn't move where they are. So we found right away that our first gene, crupule, and this is crupule early. This is the embryo that I showed you a second ago. And this is a plot of the hunchback expression domain in red, like I showed you before. And this one, the green one, is the expression pattern of crupule at this early time. And this is the crossover point of about 50%. Now, if you look later, the hunchback gradient and the crupule gradient, you can see a lot more overlap here. And you actually see that quite nicely here. So this is the crupule gradient here in blue, which is shifted anteriorly at the same time that the hunchback gradient is sharpening. And the hunchback, oh sorry, that's the yellow one here. That becomes really sharp. And if we look at where the 50% level is for this crupule domain, that is at a much higher concentration of hunchback. So this is actually changing its apparent sensitivity or the apparent overlap between the expression domains. And so this suggests that hunchback may not be the most critical factor for setting where this boundary is. But for other genes, it looks like it is because they move very nicely with the gradient. And actually, we went a little further because if it's not hunchback doing it, what is it? And we think it's this other gene, giant, which is in the anterior part of the embryo. And this time, giant is in red, and we have the same kind of thing. And if you look early, there's a threshold of about 12 to 14%. Oh crap, this should say maximum giant concentration. And that doesn't change when you look later. Because, so this one is the early pattern, which corresponds with the green one here, and the yellow one is the one that corresponds with the blue one here. So this is coming forward at the same time that this one is retracting. Yeah? That's right, the dynamics, but we measure both the giant gradient and the Kruppel grade and the Kruppel response in the same embryo. And she's done this for, I would say, 8 or so embryos at both of these time points, and this actually looks quite good. And this is an example of another target gene, KNURPS, which does move with the hunchback gradient. So this is the early gradient here in red, and KNURPS is back here, and that moves forward at the same time that this sharpens. And so what we can do is, so these guys, actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 target responses seem to move with the hunchback gradient, and this one doesn't. And so we think that we can make some generalizations here that where the critical part of this patterning gradient is in a certain concentration range. And that concentration range is somewhere in the 8 to 30% range. Okay? Is that all right? You guys following me? We are getting tired, I know. But I think that's a range that we can sort of live with. And one way we can test that is by doing this ventral misexpression and trying to measure the ventral misexpression gradient that we have and seeing if we have the same kind of response. And this embryo with a ventral expression domain of a single copy. And this is the wild-type hunchback expression domain. And if we put a box like this, we can measure the ectopic gradient. And the ectopic gradient that we see is like this. It's between 15 and 20% of the maximum hunchback concentration. So this should actually still be capable of repressing any of those genes that are in that low concentration threshold. Okay? And this is just an example. She's done this on all the pairs of genes. And I think if you look here, it's really hard to convince yourself that the red one is being repressed more than the green one. And you can't do this without trying to quantify it. But the quantification is done where you look only in the red channel in this region of the embryo or only in the green channel. And you don't move where the region of the embryo is. And basically what this says is that even skip stripe 4, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, is more posterior than nubbin. So there's a little bit of red on that side. And you can see that beautifully here in these graphs. So that's right. The solid line is an average. That's right. That's right. Yeah. But you can see that this is one or two nuclei anterior to where the E4 response is. And if you actually look at this and plot that in the opposite direction, the nubbin response, let's see, I'm gonna screw this up. E4 is more sensitive to repression than this one because the repressor comes from this side. Does that make sense? You guys okay? Nikolaus? Yes. So this detects the endogenous expression pattern because it's on the dorsal side. Okay? And what this says, if you look here, this is a curve that is this target gene nubbin, which this boundary is made by repression by hunchback coming from this side. And by showing that there is nubbin expression in an anterior couple of cells compared to the stripe 4 response, you can see that this is a little bit less sensitive than 4. Okay? Or it's in a position which is consistent with that. And so we expect that the E4 response, so what we do is we put this box here because we want to measure how sensitive they are from the repression gradient coming from the ventral side of the embryo. But when you do that, we turn it like this. So that now the repression domain is coming from the from this side of the embryo, and the E4 is more strongly repressed compared to the nubbin expression domain, which is exactly what you see here. So it's consistent with the idea that it actually is the hunchback concentration that is determining the slight difference between these two different expression domains. And she's done this on all of the different pairs of target genes, and I won't belabor you with the rest of it, but this is the summary that we have. So this is the hunchback repression gradient. We think that hunchback is, it's involved in repression of Kupel, but it actually is involved to make this boundary by potentiating the ability of giant, which I don't show here, to act as a repressor of this boundary. But in this region between E3, nubbin, PDM2, E4, KNURPS, in this region here, between sort of this much hunchback concentration and this one, it looks like there's a range where the thing can act as a repressive morphogen. Out here, we know that that hunchback is involved in mediating the repression of giant, but it cannot do it by itself. And we actually show that Kupel, this is going to be a little too complicated, I think, which is expressed in this middle domain here because it's the anterior boundary of Kupel. Kupel is required for hunchback to repress giant. So this is a combinatorial one. So what this says to me is that when you're looking at one of these gradients, if you're at sort of the top of the gradient, there's not much positional information. And if you're way down here, there's not much positional information, but you can actually position something further out by having a combinatorial mechanism. But in that middle region, there is the potential for the protein itself to be the main factor that positions things in precise places. Rolf? I don't know. Because you would imagine that here you're having the biggest drop and it should have the most information. But that's actually not what we see. I would have guessed that. Oh, I think that's exactly what we think, but the input information is refining and it's moving. So that means that the things that are responding to it can move as well. And actually, John Reinitz has done some nice things showing that the gap genes actually move forward in their latest paper. But they don't have a mechanism for how that could happen. But I think it's the refinement of the hunchback, this repression gradient, that's a big part of that. I don't think we're playing at all with the threshold that has to do with the concentration that you need to go from an off position to a non position. And I think we can basically demonstrate that threshold is not changing over time. That's what we always had a problem before, because when you look at individual genes in individual embryos, you had such a hard time with the timing, because we could see that these things are moving. So if you look at nubbin, for example, at one time, and you look at it at a slightly different time, it moved. But unless you look simultaneously at two genes and you follow them through the whole process, then you can't really determine the spatial relationship of those two genes. And that's what we tried to do here, is really determine what the spatial relationship is and then try to correlate that with the amount of hunchback as a relative amount of hunchback that's required to make these different boundaries. I think this is like as much as we can do at the present time with the technology that we have, but I think we need better visualization technology to go forward in the future. But okay, now, let's see. And this was just to say why. Okay, so one thing, so what you would expect is for E3, I showed you that E3 has a very weak cluster of hunchback binding sites, and that's what makes it less sensitive to repression by hunchback compared to E4, right? And so you would expect that the hunchback clusters for nubbin, PDM2, E4, KNURPS, that those would be somehow similar. But we don't see any similarity in the hunchback clusters that we can see either by hunchback site number, hunchback whatever relative affinity means for hunchback. And what we don't think is that the sensitivity is really determined by the binding site composition of hunchback, but rather it's determined by the context that that each element has with respect to what's activating it. I don't know if I said that very well at all. But the reason we think that is that I think repressors are going to be fundamentally different than activators. And the reason is because of this. The activation is complicated, as I was saying before. And this is just a drawing from Lemon and Tijan a few years ago showing some of the complications. So this is the basal promoter here. This is some kind of a regulatory element. You have to have contacts between the glucocorticoid receptor, which is here, which in this regulatory element, and this. And it's actually a quite complicated process that involves enhancer binding, looping, acetylation, contact with the base of machinery, phosphorylation, and all of these things. And repression is flexible because you can interfere with any of these things. And if you think about an enhancer element, I showed you, or I can show you experiments where if you interfere with a single activator site, the element won't work anymore. And so a single binding site for a repressor that's in the right position could have a very effective repression activity on an element. I think this is a good place to stop. That's one way I could explain what we see. Yeah. So I had another whole thing. But we can do that some other time. Okay. I'll stop. Any more questions? You guys are amazingly great question askers. Yeah. I don't think we can't answer that question because the tools that we have to detect them are antibodies. And antibodies have different specificities, and we can't really quantify the specificity of each antibody, but if we could, we could. I think the best way to do that would be something that's sort of in the future, and that would be to replace the genes with a gene that is a EGFP fusion, that makes an EGFP fusion protein, like Gregor and these guys did with Bicoid. These are complex experiments, though, because they're large pieces of DNA that you have to get into the genome. But as Eric was saying, these guys are doing recombineering techniques where you can really work with big pieces of DNA, and I think this stuff will come quite soon.